So we had some technical difficulties, as you saw. And I just want you to know, if you glanced back there and you saw somebody that you didn't recognize, that's Jimmy. He's kind of new here. He's from Meadow Lake. He's been here for a few months in the youth group. And what happened wasn't his fault. So I just want to let you know, like, he's a cool guy. You should get to know him. He's really cool. So, what happened, I think there's a little bit of a miscommunication with between me and somebody who was supposed to do sound. So he just learned to do easy worship last week. So that's what happened. It's just kind of messed up there. So with that being said, it was cold last night, if you guys didn't realize that. Like, it got cold really quick. And I just want to let you know, if you guys like having Leah and I around, you should make sure that you thank Peter Hill today, because yesterday our furnace stopped working. Like, I was sitting there next to the window, and it just got colder and colder and colder, and it kept getting colder, and I thought, I wonder if the heat's working. So I looked, and then I went over to it and kind of held my hand over the vent, and it wasn't working, and then the fan wasn't blowing at all. So I turned the fan on, the fan started blowing, and it still was just blowing cold air. So I thought, that's weird. So I went down, and there was no flame. Like, there's a little hole in little metal box, and you can look in there and see the flame, and there was no flame there. So I did like anybody in my generation does. I went to Google and looked, you know, well, why would the ignition stop working or whatever? And so I was trying to figure out what was going on, and I read something about the particular brand of furnace that I have, that it's really finicky, and that you're going to have to buy a new igniter every year. And of course, it's always the people who have the problems who go on there and say stuff bad about it, and then, you know, you think that it's just this terrible thing. And so I was freaking out and everything, and I called Devin, and he told me what I should do, and that was call Peter. So so I called, and I said, well, it's kind of late, don't you think? And Devin said, well, if it was me, I would call him this late. So I thought, okay, that's fine. So I called him, and he came over, and it was really something pretty simple. The pipe had gotten, the exhaust, or the intake pipe had gotten stopped up, so it wasn't getting air. So it works, and our house is warm now. So thanks to Peter Hill, we didn't die of frostbite last night. So that's there you go. He deserves a round of applause. So I'm gonna preach today. It kind of worked out kind of funny, because I talked to Pastor Devin the other day about me preaching today, and he said, yeah, that could be fine. And then he called me yesterday and told me that he was sick, so he wouldn't be here today. And he didn't know what he was going to do and stuff. And he was like, oh, yeah, you're preaching, right? And I was like, yeah. So I don't know. Either he's actually sick, or he decided that since I was preaching, he'd take the Sunday off. So you don't know with that guy. No, I'm just kidding. He's not feeling well, so hopefully he'll be doing better. So when I was in third grade, that was a long time ago, down in Boiling Springs, South Carolina, we got to school one morning, and the teacher had warned us that there was going to be a tornado drill. We don't live in, like, I'm not from, like, Tornado Alley or anything like that, but anytime there's a hurricane, because of the distance where we were from the shore, and there were mountains and stuff close by, typically what would happen is hurricanes would kind of hit the shore, and on the outskirts, when they hit the mountains, that would kind of stir up tornadoes. So it was pretty common to have tornadoes, usually just really short ones, all that kind of stuff. So we had to have tornado drills. And if you've ever been in a tornado drill in a school, in an elementary school, typically what you do is you take a book, and I don't have any up here, and I left my Bible down there, but you take a book and you put it over your head and neck, and then you get down and, like, lean up against the wall so that your head doesn't get crushed by falling debris and all that kind of thing. It never made much sense to me how it would actually protect you, but, you know, that's what they did. So so there was supposed to be a tornado drill this day. And so everybody was expecting it or whatever. And this particular day, I was kind of hyper. I wasn't a hyper kid. I was actually a pretty laid-back kind of kid. I didn't really goof off too much. I never really got in trouble. I was a pretty good kid. I was a pretty boring kid, I guess. Anyway, after lunch, we took our trays from the table to throw them away. And I was at the front of the line. I don't know how I ended up at the front of the line, but I went through and dumped our trays and that kind of stuff. And we were supposed to walk alongside the wall and then stop at the doorway and then not go outside. And then we'd go outside around to the classroom. But I was just kind of goofing off in my own little world, and I kept walking. I just walked right out the door. And it was a nice day. It was good, and I looked, and, you know, it was warm and everything, the opposite of today. And I realized, oh, wait, I'm outside. Because something kind of struck me and made me, I guess, kind of brought me back to reality. And I realized what it was the fire alarm went off. And I heard it buzzing, and I was like, whoa, what's going on? So I jumped back inside. And you could tell the difference between a tornado and a fire alarm. We kind of learned the difference and that kind of stuff. And this wasn't the tornado alarm. This wasn't the tornado drill. This was the fire alarm. So everybody was freaking out. They thought that there was a fire. So I jumped back inside, and I stopped just right inside the door, and I looked, and the teacher was looking at me like I had done something terribly wrong. And I thought, oh, man, I shouldn't have stepped outside. And she walked towards me like if she had had a whip or something, she probably would have hit me with it pretty hard. But I've never been looked at that way by a teacher in my life up to that point. So I was standing there, and as the teacher walked towards me, I kind of shifted a little bit, and I hit my head on something. And I realized what it was. I turned around, and the fire alarm had been pulled behind me. And I hit my head on it, and I'm like, what's going on? So she walked up, and here I was in front of this fire alarm that had been pulled, and she thought it was me. And she said, did you pull the fire alarm? I said, no, I accidentally went outside. And she was like, don't lie to me. And I was like, well, no, I didn't pull the fire alarm. I hit my head on it, and she was like, Brandon, I know that you pulled the fire alarm. And I was like, I didn't pull the fire alarm. She didn't believe me. So anyway, we went outside because the fire alarm went off. So even if, you know, there's not a fire, you're supposed to go out or whatever. So we went outside, and I was sitting here freaking out, and everybody was like, I can't believe you did that, Brandon. And I was like, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And the guy who was standing next to me was like, I think you hit your head on it. I think you hit your head on it. And that made it come out. And I was like, yeah, maybe so. That makes sense. So anyway, we were standing out there, and everybody, our principal's name was Mr. Ledford. And everybody was like, Mr. Ledford's a good guy. You'll be okay. It's okay, Brandon. Don't worry about it. And the guy who was right behind me in line was the most comforting. It took me, I wasn't putting two and two together at that point. I did a couple of weeks later. But anyway, he was being very, you know, oh, it's okay. You'll be okay. I'll stick up for you. I know that you didn't pull it. And so we were standing there and looked over. First graders had come outside with books on their head. Because I guess they got kind of confused. So we were standing there, and I kind of chuckled inside about that. But then we ended up going inside, and I got sent to the principal's office. And so I explained to him, you know, I hit my head on it, and that's all that I know. I didn't do it. I didn't pull it. I didn't do anything on purpose. If, you know, my hair got stuck on it and I pulled it on accident, maybe that's what happened, but I don't know. And then so he brought the two witnesses, a guy named Travis and a guy named Jerry, and brought them in there and asked them what happened. They were like, yeah, he came in and hit his head on it and all this kind of stuff. And so the principal was like, well, I don't really know. So, of course, my mom got called, and she came in. And finally he decided, you know what, I don't know if you did it or not, Brandon, so I'm just going to leave out any kind of punishment at school, and I'll let your parents deal with it. And so my parents dealt with it, and they didn't believe me either. It was really frustrating. And I think I got asked for the next 3 or 4 weeks about 4 times a day by one of my parents or one of my siblings. Did you pull the fire alarm? You can tell me. I won't be mad at you. Did you do it? And every time the answer was no, because I didn't do it. So anyway, he said, there's no, going to be no school punishment. Just, you know, deal with your family at home. And so my mom, she grounded me from TV for like 2 weeks, I think. And that was pretty tough. I'm not going to lie. But then I got to school the next day, and I went into my classroom, and I saw on the board detention. Like, you know, there was the side of the board where people who had recess detention got their names put. I think I had had it one time for talking when I wasn't supposed to. And other than that, that's all. But my name was up there, and it said 2 weeks. And I was like, what? I didn't. And so I talked to Ms. Johnson, my teacher, and I was like, I didn't do anything. I didn't pull the fire alarm. And she was like, yeah, you pulled the fire alarm, Brandon. I said, no, Mr. Ledford said there wasn't going to be any school-related punishment. And then she was like, well, he didn't tell me that. So I guess she didn't get the memo. But I ended up having recess detention for 2 weeks, which is really difficult for a third grader. Basically, the way that would work is I would you would go and everybody else would go outside. And they always put it in the classroom that was right next to the like the edge of the building. So you could kind of glance out the windows and see all of your friends playing and having a great time and, you know, laughing and you know, just amazing things were happening out there while you were inside. And if you didn't have any work to do, which I usually didn't because I usually got my work finished while I wasn't supposed to, while the teacher was still talking. I was just that kid. And so I never had any homework to do or anything, so I would have to sit there. And what you would have to do if you didn't have work to do is watch the clock. Have you ever watched the clock for 30 minutes straight? It's impossible. I've never been in such captivity and in such like internal prison than I have when I was sitting there watching the clock. And I had to wait and wait. And 2 weeks of recess detention is ridiculous for a third grader. I can look back on it and think, oh, it's not a big deal, you know, whatever. It's kind of funny. But at that point, like it seemed so difficult. It seemed so hard. It seemed so long that I was going to have to wait. And I actually had to wait 4 more years until I finally convinced Travis, the guy who I was telling you about, who was really comforting. I kind of finally convinced him to admit to me that he was the one who pulled the fire alarm. It was on the bus, and I was like, hey, remember that time in third grade when I got in trouble for pulling the fire alarm? And he kind of got a smirk on his face. Yeah, I remember that. And I was like, did you pull it? And he was like, I won't be mad if you did. And he was like, yeah, I did. So finally, you know, I was vindicated, and everything was okay, but I got bugged about that for years and years. But the point in that whole story was that I felt like I was in prison because everybody thought that I did something that I didn't do. And like I said, in hindsight, it's not a big deal. It's kind of funny. It's a good story. But I felt like everybody thought that I did something, that everybody looked down on me. Everybody kind of cast me down. It's, you know, that person, I can't believe he would do that. That's so dumb that he would pull the fire alarm. And I felt like that. And, you know, and people gave me a hard time about it for years, all of my family and everybody. But that 2 weeks that I had to sit there every day and watch the clock during recess, as far as I was concerned, like it was prison. That was captivity. I had to wait and wait and wait and wait. And I'm sure all of you can think of times where you had to wait for something. Some of it might be a silly story like that where you were a kid and you had to wait for Christmas or you had to wait for this or that. And we can also look back on times that you had to wait for something else, or you felt like you were in captivity over something, or you felt like you were in prison over something. You know, I know we have some people here who actually have been in prison. Some of you have lost loved ones, have lost husbands and wives and children and mothers and fathers. And in those times, you feel like you're in prison. You feel like you're in captivity. As Devin shared just a couple of weeks ago, Advent is all about waiting. As we've said over and over again, Advent is all about waiting. But what are we waiting on? Are we waiting on just Christmas to come so we can have time with our family and kind of, you know, hang out and get presents and that kind of stuff? Or is it something much deeper than that? See, I think a lot of times at Christmas, we kind of miss the point. We know what Christmas is all about. And we know that it's all about Christ, but we get caught up into thinking that it's about presents, or it's about family, or it's about, you know, good memories and sentimental songs and movies and all this kind of stuff. I know it's really hard for us to admit this, but the first thing that we think about when we hear the word Christmas or when we think about Christmas time, maybe a couple of you, but I think that most of us, and myself included, if I raised my hand and said, you know, I think about Jesus when I think about Christmas, I would be lying. I think most of you would too. Because we think about, you know, family. We think about, you know, how are we going to work out, you know, I've got to go to this part of my family's on Christmas Day. I've got to go to this part of my family's on Christmas Eve. And how am I going to work that out? You know, there's that strife and what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Or presents, you know, who do I have to buy for? How much is it going to cost? You know, who else is going to buy for us? If they buy me something, do I have to buy them something back? You know, those kind of things like cross our minds all the time. You know, maybe you get excited or maybe you get annoyed at the prospect of Christmas music and Christmas movies and everything being Christmas this and Santa Claus that and the Grinch and snowmen and all this kind of stuff. And maybe that excites you. Maybe it annoys you. I don't know. There's different people. But that's what Christmas is to us. That's what we think about when we think about Christmas. See, we end up being held captive by what everybody else expects. We end up being held captive by what our family expects of us. We end up being being held captive by how much we've got to spend on this or that or what presents we have to buy. And Christ is usually down toward the bottom of our list. And when we do think of him, we often put him in the Christmas Jesus category. You know, at Christmas, Jesus is just a cute little baby that lays in a manger. He doesn't demand anything of us. He's just cute and we can celebrate him and that kind of thing. But what we forget is the fact that the baby Jesus in the manger was God in the flesh come to earth to live alongside of humanity. So at Christmas, we shouldn't just celebrate his birth, but we should celebrate his coming, the inauguration of his ministry, the inauguration of his kingdom. See, in the book of Luke, we see a telling of Jesus' birth and the events that kind of surrounded it. And then it goes on into John the Baptist, who is preparing the way for Jesus. And then it says Jesus gets baptized. And then he goes out and he spends 40 days in the desert being tempted. And then something else happens. And I'm gonna start in verse 14 of Luke chapter 4. It says, Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through the whole countryside. He was teaching in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began by saying to them, "Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." See, he opened up to Isaiah, what we know as Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 through 3. And I'm going to kind of go through that, or actually verses 1 and 2. But I'm going to go through those three verses, Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 through 3, and just kind of pull some things out of it, because I think when Jesus said that, because that was kind of one of the things that kind of started off his ministry, I think he was saying, this is what my ministry is all about. This is what I'm coming for. So when we think about Christmas and we think about Advent, we need to think about why Jesus came. And this is one of the things. So, in Isaiah 61, I'm going to read this again, chapter 61, verses 1 through 3. It says, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor." See, he claims that the Spirit is on him because God has anointed him. And the Spirit enables him to do these things. And I'm going to mention the first four. To preach good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, to release from darkness the prisoners. See, all of these people here are people who are cast down. The poor, brokenhearted, captives, prisoners. People that are often thought of as kind of the lesser people of society. And these are the people who Jesus came for. The people who are burdened financially, the poor. I don't know if you've ever been in a place where you weren't sure if you were going to have enough money to eat that day or not, or if you weren't sure if you're going to have enough to pay the bills or to take care of your family. If you've ever been in that kind of a place, it's not fun. And good news, there isn't good news I mean, when it comes down to it, if you're worried about whether or not you're going to be able to afford to keep the lights on, you're not going to have good news. Even the best news, it doesn't matter, because what are you going to do? But Christ came to preach good news to the poor. Those who are burdened emotionally, the brokenhearted. Once again, if you've ever experienced loss of a loved one, you know what it means to be brokenhearted. And what Christ came to do is to bind up the brokenhearted, to fix the brokenhearted. So those who are burdened financially, those who are burdened emotionally, and those who are captive to somebody else. It says the captive, to proclaim freedom for the captives. Those who are locked in darkness, prisoners. And one of my favorite passages, and some of you know this, this was the first thing I preached on when I first came here, is from John chapter 1 and verses 4 and 5. It says, "In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it." See, we light these Advent candles to remind us of that light, to remind us that that's who Jesus is. He's the light. The light of all mankind. And he shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And so when Jesus was quoting this, when he was saying, I came to release from darkness the prisoners, he's saying that he's the light, and he's giving light to them. He's giving light to those people who are in darkness. And so he goes on, and it says, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God. The year of the Lord there, it's connected to the idea of jubilee. In Leviticus 25, starting in verse 8, it says, "Count off seven Sabbath years, seven times seven, so that the seven Sabbath years amount to a period of 49 years." A lot of numbers there. "Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the seventh month. On the Day of Atonement, sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. Do not sow and do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines, for it is a jubilee and it is to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee, everyone is to return to their own property." In other words, he's saying every 50 years, you're going to have this celebratory year. And if you're a slave, if you've sold yourself, if you're an indentured servant, then you're free. Go back to your family. Go back to your own clan. If you owe money, you don't owe it anymore. If you owe this to this person and this to that person, it's free. Just let it go. Everything's free. Proclaim liberty throughout the land. I'm not going to lie. I think this is a pretty good idea. I wish that they would do it here to say, you know, well, every 50 years, if they just kind of dropped, you know, every bit of money that you owed or you didn't owe anything, that would be nice. Hopefully, the 50th year is coming up pretty soon. In reality, though, this is what it's talking about. So when Jesus comes and he says, "It's the year of the Lord. I've come to proclaim the year of the Lord," he's basically saying everybody's returning to freedom. During Jubilee, slaves were set free, debts were forgiven. So when Jesus declares the year of the Lord's favor, he's saying that the slaves are set free, the debt is paid. And then it says, the day of vengeance of our God. That seems a little bit different. The rest of this is all good news and happy and hopeful and that kind of stuff. But then it says the day of vengeance. See, I think that here vengeance is against those who oppress the poor, those who hold others captive, in the sense of jubilee. But if we look ahead to what Christ said and what Christ did, we know that God's vengeance is poured out upon sin and death, because they're the ones who hold us captive, really. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 54, it says, "When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" See, it's saying that God's vengeance is going to be poured out on that, poured out on sin and death, and we're going to be released from captivity for that. That's what Jesus came from. In verse 56 of Corinthians 15, it says, "The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." He gives us victory. And then it says in Isaiah that he comes to comfort all who mourn. I think the picture that's created here is one where people are cast down in sadness and poverty and captivity. Sometimes physical, sometimes spiritual. Some of you may be mourning. Some of you may have lost somebody that you love. Maybe you're mourning over your own sin. Maybe you're poor physically. Maybe you can't pay your bills. Maybe you're poor spiritually because you don't know God. You have no clue where you're going in this life. Maybe you're captive or imprisoned. Maybe captive to sin. Captive to sin and the addictions that sin brings. But at the same time, there's people who are literally captive. I was looking the other day that there's 1.2 million children who are trafficked every year. In other words, they're bought, sold, kidnapped, or traded for forced labor or sexual exploitation. That's not a pretty sight. That's not a pretty sound. It's not something good to think about. That's 1.2 million children. But there's 5.7 million children who are currently held in forced labor who haven't necessarily been trafficked. Christ came to be the hope for those in captivity. I have some friends, Leah and I have friends who are involved at a church in Nicaragua that runs a home for girls and women who've been rescued from slavery, typically forced prostitution. And a few weeks ago, I received a message from my buddy Sean, who said that there was a little girl named Alma who was 11 years old and that she had been rescued, that they had taken her from her home. She had been adopted into a family that treated her like a slave. They forced her into prostitution. They chained her up. And it was terrible. It was a ridiculous situation. And they had rescued her. And it said that she had been able to be a kid for the first time, going to school, playing on a swing set, watching TV, and eating pizza. I don't know how long she was there, but she was there for a while, and it was good, and everything was going well. But then she was kidnapped, probably by her mother. They never found her. They don't know if she got sold or what happened to her. But I don't say this to make you sad or make you think, oh man, that poor girl. I say this to remind you that we still live in a broken world. But for that little girl, Christ is the hope. Because Christ came to set the captive free. But we still live in a broken world and things haven't quite been made fully right yet. And that's why we celebrate Advent. That's why we sing, O Come, Emmanuel. Because he came already, and he proved who God was, and he showed that God loved us, and he died for us. But he's going to come again and finish everything up. And it says in Isaiah, it says, you'll be given a crown of beauty instead of ashes. You know, a lot of cultures put ash on their head to mourn or whatever. Jesus comes to replace that with a crown. He gives the oil of gladness instead of mourning, replaces mourning with gladness because of the hope that he gives. A garment of praise in place of a spirit of despair. And finally, it says they will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. Back home, there's a lot of really old houses and stuff, like 200, 250 years old. In some places towards the coast, like in Charleston, there's there's places that are 300 years old or older. And a lot of times you'll see these trees. They're usually oak trees, and they're huge. Like a 300-year-old oak tree is absolutely huge. I mean, you could take a truck to it, and the truck would be smashed, and the tree wouldn't even feel it. And so when it says that God's gonna take those who are broken and make them into strong oaks, it says they will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. That's what we wait for at Advent. Before Christ, they waited patiently for the prophesied Messiah who would set things right, who would fight off their oppressors, who would do exactly these things. And Christ came, and he did that. But he's called us to continue it as his people, as his followers, because Christ has inaugurated his kingdom. He's called us to be a part of it. But we await when he comes to fulfill it completely. I think it's like daybreak. I tried to hunt a few times the past couple of weeks. I did kill a deer, but she ran away. I didn't kill her quick enough. She ran away, and somebody found her a couple days later. So I fed some coyotes. But other than that, I didn't get anything. And there was one morning that I went out before daybreak, and I kind of walked to the blind just as the light was coming over behind me from the east. As soon as the light came out, I could see. It was dark. As soon as the light came out, I could see a little bit, but I couldn't see perfect. And I sat, and I waited, and it was cold, and the wind was blowing, and I waited, and I sat, and I sat, and I sat, and the sun got higher and higher and higher until finally I could actually see. I could see a little bit. I could see enough to know where I was. I could see enough to know if a deer had come out in front of me, but I couldn't see enough to shoot. Ended up a deer didn't come out, and that was kind of sad. But I did think about the fact that daybreak brings light, but noonday is when you can see. And so I think it's kind of like when Jesus came, what we celebrate, Jesus' birth, it's like daybreak. It's like it's been night, and you see the first light out on the east. I was pointing the wrong way. Out on the east, coming up. And you know that night is almost over. You know that the darkness is fleeing. The darkness is leaving, and light is on its way. So when Christ came, light began peering over the horizon. We celebrate Christ coming at Christmas because it gives us hope, because we know that a day is coming and the night is almost over. He said, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So Advent and Christmas remind us that Christ has come and that we have hope. We have good news of this kingdom and his welcoming us into this kingdom. So how do we respond to that? And I'm just going to tell you real quick how I think that we should respond to this passage. The first way is that we look to Christ and have hope. We look to Christ because we know that he's God in the flesh. We know that he is God dwelling among us. And because when we look to him, we hear that good news that he came to proclaim to the poor. He binds up the brokenhearted. He proclaims freedom for the captive, release from darkness for the prisoner. And when it comes down to it, all of us without Christ are captive to sin. All of us without Christ are imprisoned in darkness. All of us without Christ are spiritually poor. And all of us without Christ will end up brokenhearted. Turning to Christ doesn't fix everything, but it gives us hope that one day everything's going to be made right. If you don't know Christ, get to know him. Read his word, see in Christ a king and a savior. That's who he is. That's what he came to be. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. Once you've done that, if you've already done that, follow Christ's example. Back quite a few years ago, there was that fad of wearing those WWJD bracelets, what would Jesus do? Unfortunately, I think most people who wore them actually just did it because it was kind of the fad. Or it was where I was from. Maybe it wasn't that big of a thing here. But there were people who, I mean, had them all the way up their arms. Like, Leah's laughing. I think she probably was one of them. I think I had one or two. But we would, everybody had them. It was so cool. And nobody really looked at them, though. Nobody really thought, you know, what would Jesus do in this situation? It was just kind of a piece of jewelry. It wasn't even jewelry. It was like cloth or plastic or something. It's really difficult to figure out what Jesus would actually do in any given situation. I was looking on Amazon, and there's a book. There's a book called What Would Jesus Buy? There's one called What Would Jesus Ask? What Would Jesus Eat? What Would Jesus Deconstruct? I don't know. What would Jesus say? What would Jesus pray? What would Jesus think? What would Jesus drive? What would Jesus sing? How would Jesus vote? Who would Jesus kill? Who would Jesus bomb? Just all kinds of books where somebody is trying to say, well, this is what Jesus would do. This is what Jesus would think. This is how Jesus would act, so this is how you should act. And I'm sure that most of those are just filled with speculation. You know, well, this is what Jesus would do. Jesus looks a lot like me, so you should all be like me. That kind of thing. You can't really say, well, Jesus would do this specifically and that specifically. But I do know that in general, I do know what Jesus would do. He would proclaim good news to the poor. He would bind up the brokenhearted. He would proclaim freedom for the captives. He would release from darkness the prisoners. He would proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He would comfort all who mourn. He would provide for those who grieve in Zion. He would bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise. So the way that I think that we should respond to this, knowing that this is why Christ came, this is part of what he came to do, we look to him and we have hope. And we follow him. If we're going to celebrate Christmas right, then we need to turn to Christ and follow him. We need to turn to Christ. Trust in the hope that he gives and bestow that hope to other people. Let's pray. Father, I ask that you would be with us as we go from this place trying to be people who turn to you before we turn to other things. Trying to be people who trust in the hope that you've given us and who show that hope to other people. God, if there's anybody here who doesn't know you, I ask that you would just work in their lives. Impress upon them the need to place their trust in you and in your Son. And God, those of us who do know you, impress upon us the need to actually follow you, to actually put you at the center of everything that we do. Because you're Lord of all. And you've given your Son the kingdom. And you've invited us to be a part of it. God, we love you. We ask that you would be with us through this Christmas season. Help us to celebrate it right by trusting in you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.